when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality. Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from Al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across, and that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters. But choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome our Kish airline. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that a price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The China Global Television Network and Chinese Public Opinion Institute have conducted a survey in Afghanistan and 24 global countries to assess the 20-year American war on Afghanistan.
Now, the Taliban will pay a price.
At the beginning of its presence in Afghanistan, the U.S. made a commitment to build a stable, strong, and prosperous Afghanistan, claiming it would establish democracy, fight against terrorism, and rebuild the nation. Nearly 79% of the Afghan respondents polled said the U.S. did not keep its promise, while 80% termed the U.S. war in their country a complete failure.
The U.S. never abided by its promises. Current disasters in Afghanistan have all resulted from the U.S. failures. We would witness better days today if the U.S. hadn't occupied our country. 20 years ago, the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan, and today they have control again. So what did the years of U.S. war and huge expenses change in our country? The U.S. claimed to bring prosperity in Afghanistan. Instead, it destroyed everything.
During the war, Afghanistan faced severe challenges with regards to security, economy, and people's livelihoods. Some 56.6% of Afghan respondents said the U.S. left the Afghan economy worse than it was in 2001. Yet 80% of global respondents believe that the causes of local terrorism still exist in the war-ravaged country.
I've been in Afghanistan through the U.S. invasion. I agree with the results of the poll. The U.S. came to our country claiming to counter terrorism and help the Afghan economy grow, but practically none of them materialized. The U.S. institutionalized fraud and abuse. As a result, today Afghans don't have food to eat and terrorism threats are rising.
Meanwhile, 68% of the respondents said the U.S. war in Afghanistan has caused the U.S. to continue to lose its credibility with the international community. Some 65% of those surveyed in Afghanistan said they believe neighboring countries, including Iran, Pakistan, and China, play a key role in the rebuilding of the war-battered nation. 70% of global respondents described Washington seizing Afghanistan's assets as pure looting. They called on the U.S. to return Afghans' money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Biri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shiite cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks. But 1 month has passed, and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light, that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life, life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men boarded a flight to Italy on August 31st. But al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
The Iranian foreign minister's short-notice visit to Russia carries major messages, as it comes at a time when Tehran is carefully examining the recent U.S. draft response to the 2015 deal, which holds Russia as one of its signatories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was warmly greeted in Moscow on Wednesday by his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. The Russian foreign minister once again reaffirmed his country's support for a fair deal or no deal.
The Russian Federation shares the same stances as Iran towards the 2015 deal. We believe that the U.S.'s illegal sanctions against Iran must be removed to save the deal.
Meanwhile, Tehran and Washington are currently exchanging comments on the European Union's new draft proposal for the revival of what is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has repeatedly said it wants a sustainable accord, which includes guarantees that would make the deal immune to any possible withdrawal by the U.S. administration.
My colleagues are thoroughly reviewing the American text. We seek stronger and more reliable guarantees from the U.S. to prevent any future withdrawal from the deal by the U.S. government.
The 2015 deal was cast into limbo in 2018 when Washington unilaterally walked out of the accord and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Iran, in return, scaled back some of its commitments to the pact, saying it will return to its obligations only after the U.S. removes all anti-Iran sanctions. The Vienna talks over the revival of the accord have faced a hiatus over the past 5 months. The discussions are now set to resume after Iran approves and accepts the U.S. draft response.
The Iranian foreign minister's visit to Moscow is of great significance, since Russia is a key player in the 2015 deal and shares Iran's stance in the accord. Now, while the United States' response to the EU draft proposal is still under examination in Tehran, here, Sergei Lavrov says Russia will accept nothing less than Tehran's full rights under the agreement. Yusuf Jalali, Moscow.
On the 30th of August last year, the last of the U.S. troops hastily left Kabul International Airport, marking the end of a two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. On its anniversary, the people of Afghanistan are celebrating this occasion. They say being independent and free from any occupation is a great blessing for the nation.
This is a victorious day for Afghans. 1 year ago, the U.S. occupying forces were forced to leave Afghanistan. Of course, they were defeated against the will of our people. We are proud that another invasion failed in our country.
Most Afghan people believe the U.S. invasion brought them nothing but more conflict, poverty, destruction, and suffering. They say today it is Afghans who are in charge of their own country and that they should work to build their homeland.
In the past 20 years, we didn't witness anything except bombardments, destruction, and civilian casualties. People across the country were busy burying their loved ones every day.
We've gathered here to mark Afghanistan's independence from the U.S. occupation. Last year, on this day, the U.S. withdrew from our country. We are happy that the U.S. is no more present here. But unfortunately, our country is reeling from economic problems. I hope the new rules of Afghanistan provide job opportunities and protect the rights of all Afghans.
Participants also called on the U.S. to learn from its past mistakes and stop the ongoing ill policies towards Afghanistan and its people. 1 year on, Afghans are celebrating the U.S. withdrawal from their country. People here say they are happy that the U.S. invasion was ended because they were exhausted by Americans' gross violations. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
England's healthcare service workers, receiving national praise for staying in the job through the grueling days of the pandemic to save lives. An increasing number of them, doctors, nurses, and midwives, have either quit the service or are actively considering to do so.
Profits have risen by 35% in the UK since the pandemic. More money to the rich, but not to those that are sick or for people that care for them.
The most recent culprit, poor pay. Rejecting a 4% pay increase in the face of soaring inflation, they're set to vote for industrial action.
Even with all those budgeting, we are still struggling. And so what would help in the NHS really was to increase our salary like everybody else is getting bonuses. We are not. Why? Why is this? And if you're not going to increase our salary, at least do something about transportation or even the parking. We can't be paying for things like this. It's ridiculous.
There are other reasons, too, for the exodus. A recent survey by union-led With NHS Staff Campaign found stress, burnout, a feeling of abandonment after the pandemic. Some are having to use food banks or sleep inside hospitals. And it doesn't stop there.
There were other abuses of staff which made themselves clear, which also manifested. And actually, a large part of the nursing workforce who want to learn also cite discrimination. And there's a large amount of bullying, harassment, intimidation, discrimination that goes hand in hand with not every environment within the NHS, but within certain environments.
More people leaving the NHS means more work to be done by those who stay while they wait for the tens of thousands of vacancies across the country to be filled. A negative spiral hard to overcome in addition to the cost of living crisis. And then there's the years of underfunding and a wholesale drive to privatization, regardless of which party is in power.
The plan to privatize the NHS is not piecemeal. It's wholesale. I'm afraid Labour and Tory are like this. There isn't a fundamental difference in their attitude. We're already facing a winter bed crisis now. It's August, okay? And it's only going to get worse through the winter. So there is an under-provision in order to force people who can't get adequate care from the NHS into the private sector.
Created after World War II by a Labour government, the NHS is a publicly funded healthcare system, free at the point of need. Decades later, though, it's facing acute staff shortages, underfunding, and rapid privatization, which means that the crown jewel of Britain's public healthcare provision may soon be no more. Saipur is up, London.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's wrong policies have caused many immigrants to be harassed and tortured at the American borders and even spend a long time in detention centers. Many analysts believe that Joe Biden is doing the same wrong Trump's policies against immigrants. These policies have put the lives of many immigrants in danger, and even human rights groups have reacted to U.S. President's immigration policies. In this regard, we have taken a look at some of the world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Stay tuned, please. The Truth Out website explains more about the wrong immigration policies by the U.S. administration, saying hopes for abolishing one of U.S. most harmful immigration policies, including deportation following incarceration in the criminal legal system or double punishment, are withering as the Biden administration continues to snub immigration reform. According to a recent Syracuse University report, 3,481 immigrants are currently in removal proceedings because of criminal charges, and many of them were seized upon their release from prison before they could take even a single breath in freedom. And while that number is on track to be less than last year, advocates warn that without changing the underlying laws, rules, and policies, what goes down this reporting period can go up in the next. Heidi Altman, Director of Policy for the National Immigrant Justice Center, NIJC, told Truthout, "The numbers are still astronomical in terms of sheer numbers of people deported from their loved ones after a conviction or arrest," adding, "There are many ways this could be done even without congressional action through reversal of harmful Board of Immigration Appeals precedent, through rulemaking to allow greater access to bond hearings for those detained on the basis of criminal convictions, through processes to allow those unjustly deported to be returned, and or through policy memos and training that requires officers to consider the racial bias inherent in the criminal legal system when making detention and deportation decisions. But none of that has happened. Instead of being returned to their families and communities for re-entry to society, they are often held 6 months or more in private for-profit detention facilities and then deported to countries where they may not have lived for decades. Know no one and do not speak the language." WTTW Channel 11 is a PBS member television station in Chicago, Illinois. The TV channel's website has published an article concerning this issue, saying the U.S. Supreme Court has certified its ruling allowing the Biden administration to end the Migrant Protection Protocol's policy, better known as Remain in Mexico. The policy was a part of former President Donald Trump's border policy, forcing migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. to wait in Mexico for hearings. In June, a Supreme Court decision overruled a lower court that forced the policy to be reinstated in December. But while President Joe Biden previously tried to end the policy, there has been little comment thus far on when his administration might officially follow through. Gladys Molina Alt, executive director of the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, said she has spent time along the U.S.-Mexico border and the situation remains very difficult for the migrants in limbo. Molina Alt said, "What I have seen on the ground is families, parents, we talked about having to make a difficult decision on whether they remain in Mexico waiting for their cases to be processed or make that difficult decision to have their kids across the border by themselves while they remain in Mexico. So family unity is something that we've seen be an issue at stake on the ground." She said, "We've also heard both who are in these MMPP camps talk about the security issues that they face, the kidnapping that happens, the rapes that happened, the violations of human rights for them as migrants in Mexico that take place." In addition to criticisms from the human rights organizations of the Joe Biden administration in continuing Donald Trump's wrong policies toward immigrants, some American officials have also criticized Biden administration's wrong policies toward immigrants. According to a New York Post report, the chief of the U.S. Border Patrol blamed President Biden's wrong immigration policies 2004, sparking the surge of illegal immigrants crossing into the U.S. Raul Ortiz made the frank admission that the administration's wrong policies are to blame in a recorded disposition that is part of a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security by Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody. The whistleblower.org says while many public health experts urge the Biden administration to end the use of Title 42 in immigration cases, it remained government policy to do so until April, when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, finally announced its termination. But just days before the CDC order was to take effect on May 23rd, a Trump-appointed general judge in Louisiana blocked the lifting of Title 42, claiming it violated administrative law and would cause irreparable harm. Yet opposition to the lifting of Title 42 isn't solely coming from Trump appointees and Republicans. For example, the Public Health and Border Security Act, which would require all COVID-19-related national states of emergency to be lifted before Title 42 is officially terminated, was introduced in April by Senators James Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma, and Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, along with nine other senators, including Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia. Dawn Wooten, a single mother of five, used to work as a full-time nurse at the Irvine County Detention Center in Osceola, Georgia, which was operated by the private contractor LaSalle Corrections. Though she was not officially terminated by her employer, she wasn't called back to work after she began speaking out about unimaginable atrocities being committed against immigrant detainees there. Wooten shared disturbing accounts of medical misconduct at the center, including the refusal by authorities to screen detainees for COVID-19 and the destruction of medical records. Unfortunately, these types of abuses at detention facilities aren't isolated incidents. According to Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CRU, and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU of Florida, the Glades County Detention Center in Moorhaven, Florida, has a history of radicalized violence, sexually abusive behavior, medical neglect, and inhumane treatment of immigrants. CRU and the ACLU of Florida filed a federal lawsuit in April against ICE and the National Archives and Records Administration, accusing Glades officials of deleting surveillance videos that could verify claims of abuse by detainees. The Truth Out website wrote in June 2021, Illinois passed laws that banned police from assisting ICE in making arrests and ended private civil detention facilities in the state. Following its lead, other states are starting to move legislation to protect their immigrant communities from double punishment. Most notably, the California legislature is considering the Vision Act, and advocates far and wide are excited that its potential passage in a populous and politically important state could lead other states to close the prison to deportation pipeline and further decriminalize immigration. The Vision Act would prohibit collaboration with ICE to remove people who are being released from prison to jail. Under it, immigration status will no longer be used as a determining factor in how people are treated by state and local agencies and its courts. It would also abolish certain discriminatory record-keeping and reporting requirements. According to the latest published statistics, U.S. authorities arrested more than 221,000 people at the Mexican border in May alone, which is the highest number in 1 month in more than two decades. Experts have cited extreme poverty, rampant violence, and natural disasters caused by climate change in Latin America, especially in the countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, and Honduras, for the rampant increase of immigrants to the American borders.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Meanwhile, the Taliban has marked its first year anniversary of foreign and American troops exiting with flags and chants in central Kabul, while residents rejoice that peace has come despite the deteriorating economic situation. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the U.S.'s longest war and why its intervention was a failure, as stated by their own general. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Brian Terrell joins us. He's a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa. Also joining us, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Brian Terrell. When you have a U.S. general, and it's a sobering assessment, say, quote, outcomes in a war like this, an outcome that is a strategic failure, the enemy is in charge in Kabul, there's no way else to describe that the outcome is a cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days. The fact that he's saying that it is a failure, what does that say about this war altogether?
Well, I would question whether it was a failure or not. The failure is... That presupposes that winning the war was ever something that was contemplated or even desired. As Julian Assange said back in 2011, I think, that the purpose of this war was to wash money out of the U.S. and European tax bases through Afghanistan into the hands of the transnational security elite. And as that, it's been very successful. These, billions and billions of dollars have disappeared, but they have not disappeared into thin air. They've gone into some people's pockets. And it's been it's done that quite successfully. And it does not bode well because we're continuing to foment more of these wars. And the money keeps rolling in for Raytheon and Boeing and such.
So who's making off with this money? How does that transpire? Can you give us a short version of how that happens?
Well, the Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, is formerly member of the board of directors for Raytheon Technologies. This was a great deal from the beginning for Dick Cheney and his investments during that time. I had the opportunity to visit Afghanistan. I was there 7 times from 2009 to 2018, and each visit I saw the situation deteriorate. My last visits, I would be the only Westerner leaving the airport after deplaning and going through immigration, because everybody else was going from getting on a helicopter and going to another armed compound. It was getting more and more dangerous and devolving. During that time, the United States, not the war expenses, but on the so-called reconstruction, spent more money. More money was spent reconstruction of Afghanistan than the entire Marshall Plan at the end of World War II that rebuilt the cities of Western Europe, and saw nothing of that. The only roads that were paved were between the military bases, and the only housing, was the hospitals were getting worse. I'd visit the hospitals. They were getting, the schools, everything was getting worse the whole time, every time. And the compounds where the elite lived, the oligarchs lived, they were improved. And the,
Sure. Let's see what Daniel Lazar thinks about this. Daniel Lazar, you heard our guest there. Lots of money not going for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, billions of dollars. That puts another light on this whole situation, not that it wasn't known before. Who do you think made out with all this money?
Well, it wasn't billions, it was trillions. It was an astonishing sum. And yes, it went to the arms manufacturers, the contractors, various NGOs, and countless other parasites who wound up making small fortunes off this entire misadventure. But I would emphasize that it wasn't merely a get-rich scheme. America completely lost its way. Its imperial doctrine utterly failed after 9/11. And one reason is that America was unable to admit that the country that was most responsible for that attack was Saudi Arabia. Because if America had admitted that, it would have had to essentially break relations with Riyadh and completely reconstruct or rethink its entire military presence in the Persian Gulf region. So rather than do that, America chose to blame everybody else that it possibly could instead of Riyadh. I mean, it blamed Iran, it blamed Afghanistan, it blamed Saddam Hussein. It blamed everyone. And the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq were just fantastic misadventures. I mean, just America really went crazy and really behaved in a way that was utterly irrational, even by imperialist standards. And empires often behave quite irrationally. And so the U.S. really blundered into a quagmire. It had no way of winning and never really had thought of even tried to define what meaning might even mean. And so as a result, it ran through trillions, left the country in worse shape than when it arrived, brought nothing but poverty and suffering. And now has left Afghanistan to its own devices while seizing something like $7 billion in Afghan overseas deposits. So it's just a colossal scandal, no matter how you look at it.
Indeed. One of the things there, Brian Terrell, that our guest Daniel Lazar mentioned, is the fact that they didn't know what they were doing. I'd like to expand a little bit more on that with you, because the reports that have indicated and have confirmed the fact that senior U.S. officials actually failed to tell the truth when it came to what was happening there and about the performance throughout this 20-year occupation that happened there. They actually made rosy announcements about what was going on there. They were hiding the facts and the evidence that this war had become unwinnable, but they were presenting another side to that story, a false side, that they were successful. This lying that they did was happening for a long time. Why is it then that nothing was done about the prevention of the lies, but more so for them to find a solution to improve what was going on there? Because the occupation continued, even though reports came out that they had lied about it.
Well, there's a long history of this in the Vietnam War. Of course, we have the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg released, telling that the rosy story that General Westmoreland and the presidents Nixon and Johnson were portraying were lies. Way back then, and there have been leakers, WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. People have had the courage to speak up. And what was happening to them is the punishment of the ones who told the truth. Another general who should be mentioned is General Stanley McChrystal, who was under Obama was the head of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, and he made the mistake of having a telling the truth interview with Rolling Stone magazine, and he said back then that this was unwinnable and that he was. What he said, for every innocent Afghan who's killed, the United States is creating 10 new enemies. And of course, President Obama got his job. He was demoted. He was fired for telling the truth. So the truth has been out there. The U.S. media has been very complicit in trying to silence that truth. This is not something, it's these having these generals today come out as like, who knew we were losing? Who knew that this was a waste? It really is disingenuous. I think this was something that we knew from the beginning. And in the beginning, too,
let me come to you, Daniel Lazar. I think we may have lost. I'm sorry, we lost connection with you, Brian Terrell, for a second. This is what's very confusing, Daniel Lazar, and I'd like to find out from you if you have an answer. Back in 2015, Douglas Lute is a 3-star Army general who served in the position of what's called the White House's Afghan War Czar during the Bush and Obama administration. This is what he has said. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan, and this is the part that's really shocking. We didn't know what we were doing. He says, what are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking. I'm trying to really digest that. How do you go into another country and then not know what you're doing there?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. It's very hard to understand. But remember, first of all, that after 9/11, America had to invade someone, and its primary target was Saddam Hussein in Iraq. However, the Democrats thought that was ridiculous because Al-Qaeda had a certain presence in Afghanistan. And in fact, its chief, Osama bin Laden, was actually physically located in Afghanistan. So to oblige the Democrats to satisfy their concerns, the Bush administration invaded Afghanistan, but it really invaded Afghanistan merely to show that it could invade Afghanistan using a very small force and using various allies on the ground to overthrow the regime. And that operation was highly successful, But the next day arrived and America had no idea what to do. It hadn't given any thought as to what it would do with this immense country of 40 million people once it succeeded in toppling the Taliban. So therefore, they spent 20 years dithering, in utter confusion, knowing nothing about the country itself, knowing nothing about what the goal should be, what America was doing there, anything like that. So that's what we saw. And I might add, by the way, that one of the great champions of the Afghan invasion was Joe Biden, who at the time was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a major figure in U.S. foreign policy formulation. And what was Joe Biden's punishment? obviously there was no punishment. He was rewarded by being, you know, transported into the White House, where he then was able to preside over this utter defeat that America suffered last August. It's really bonkers.
So many things here that just boggles the mind, Brian Terrell. One of them is something that actually the U.S. wants to boast that it does when it intervenes illegally in some sense into other nations. But many U.S. officials have acknowledged that Afghanistan's that the U.S. purpose there was to remake it into a modern nation, okay? So that, to me, gives the notion of nation building, in a sense. Now, this is what Obama stated after the U.S.-backed NATO invasion of Libya about his worst mistake. He said, probably failing to plan for the day after, okay, what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya. Did the U.S. think this through in terms of militarily coming in, but then what it is going to do to, in this case, rebuild the nation or to move towards nation building?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that presupposes that's actually what they wanted to do. And I think whatever the motives that someone like Obama or Biden might personally have had, the idea that if you repeat a mistake over and over and over again, repeated in Vietnam, repeated in Libya, repeated in Afghanistan, repeated, Honduras, repeated in, the list could go on and on. It's a sign of a criminal pattern. It's not good, well-intentioned people making mistakes over and over and over again. The same mistakes happened, and again with from the beginning of this, from President Carter starting to arm the Mujahideen, there were always people. There were always experts. There were always people saying, "Don't do it. Don't do it." As we're seeing in Europe now. From 1993, there were people, anybody knowing anything about the situation in Europe saying NATO cannot expand. We're not going to expand NATO. Even Joe Biden warned in 1993, warned that expanding NATO was going to provoke Russia. And look where we are. It's not a progression of the same mistakes over and over and over again is a pattern of criminality. If these people are, if these are truly mistakes, and perhaps they are, then we're being ruled by and have been ruled for decades by a government that is absolutely incapable, inept, unable to govern itself, much less trying to export itself, the idea that the United States today is trying to rebuild other nations. While our own infrastructure is falling apart, while our own education and our roads and everything that makes for a decent life, the life expectancy of Americans is going down for the first time. While we're spending more than $1 trillion on extending the life of our nuclear weapons, which are clearly illegal under all these international laws that we're party to, there may be good intentions there, but the good intentions are not. It shows how little good intentions count.
Well, I mean, to even wrap our thoughts around this is so difficult, Daniel Ozar. The U.S. government is cited by a Washington Post report that came out a few years back, in which it interviewed 400 or 500 military personnel. One of the things that it came out with was said that it deliberately misled the public, that it was common, it said, to distort statistics to make it appear that the U.S. was actually winning the war. So you're lying to the American people, you're lying to the world, really, after you spend all this money. But the way of going about lying is what I'm questioning here. When you come and you distort numbers and you mislead the public in that way, that's incredible, right? And then it's still happening because after Afghanistan, there are other wars now. I mean, we're looking at somewhat Ukraine or somewhat for the U.S. to be involved in the Ukraine conflict. What is your impression of the U.S. going about it that way?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct. It really is mind-boggling. But you've got to remember, you know, let's go back to 9/11. The U.S. had invested literally trillions of dollars in militarizing the Persian Gulf and strengthening the Saudi regime. And what it got for its efforts on September 11th, 2001, was death and destruction on an unprecedented scale in Lower Manhattan. So American policies had blown up in its face. Now, that's in any kind of honest government, that would have meant a massive reanalysis, reconceptualization, rethink of where U.S. Middle East policy was going. But that was the last thing Washington wanted to do or was even capable of doing. So as a result, America engaged in these completely eccentric, willfully, absurd actions, whose purpose was to, number one, lie to the American people about the, what had happened on 9/11. Number two, to sort of demonstrate that, to flex its military muscle to show it was still a tough guy. And number three, to knock over some unfriendly regimes in the Middle East, beginning with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and then culminating with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And by the way, if the war in Iraq had been successful, the U.S. then had a list of something like five other countries it was planning to invade, including Iran. Now, this was complete madness. It was nothing more than a gigantic temper tantrum. And it led to disaster. And it just goes to show how completely broken the American political leadership really is, and political leadership in both parties. I mean, the American government operates in a bubble. It has little understanding of the world at large, little understanding of how to conduct itself relative to the world at large, and is just careening out of control, creating disaster wherever it goes. I mean, Afghanistan was a start, but it's not the end by any means.
Well, I was trying to figure out, Brian Terrell, how much money the U.S. is spending on its involvement with the conflict in Ukraine. And I'm going to go out on a limb and ask this question if you think that my thinking here is either correct or completely out of line in a sense. You know, you have this 20-year occupation war that ended, and the fiasco that it was, and even the way it ended was a fiasco. And now that that's ended, we are seeing, about 6 months into the Ukraine conflict, we're seeing how the U.S. Is spending money. Few hundred million dollars a day is one estimate, but if you take a look at the bigger picture, it's billions of dollars. Are we looking at a pattern where there needs to be a war for the U.S. government to flow cash into it? And based on the past, like Afghanistan, there are people who are making out that are profiting from this, hence that war, the term war profiteering, which is coined from the U.S., basically, is showing itself again. Is this a pattern? That we're seeing here?
Well, yes, it is. The United States at this point, we really don't have any other product. We don't have anything to offer. Everything that we have you go in a department store in the United States and everything is made in China, or our clothing comes from Guatemala